Wilikowski, and we do, and Senator Johnny Ellis, and we do have a quorum to conduct business.
And from the House side, I'm Representative Gabrielle Nadeau, Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and with us are Representative Greenberg, my Vice Chair, Representative Keller, Representative Velik, Representative Clayman, Representative Lynn, and Representative Foster.
Okay, and so, and welcome to all of you here in the audience as well. This meeting is scheduled to go until 3:30 today, and I announced earlier we're not going to take any breaks, just keep pushing through, so feel free to leave the room as you need to for breaks. Welcome, Zoe Towns, if you'd put your name on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Zoe Towns for the Pew Charitable Trust Public Safety Performance Project. Thank you so much for having us here today, to the chairs and also to the members of both committees. We appreciate the time in your interim. So what we have prepared today is really two parts of a presentation. The first is I'm going to try and provide some context around the national trends in sentencing and corrections that really brings Pew to this conversation, and I know helped bring Alaska to this work that you're all engaging in right now with justice reinvestment. What we've got here today are four leaders from four different states, from Georgia and Utah and South Carolina and Mississippi, who are here to share some of their experiences with criminal justice reform, with sentencing and corrections reform, and hopefully we can, you all can extract some lessons that will be relevant for the work in Alaska. So let me just say first that beside me I've got Jay Neal from Georgia. Director Neal is the director of the Georgia Governor's Office of Transition Support and Reentry, and he was actually a state representative at the time when Georgia took on their criminal justice reform effort several years ago. We've also got Ron Gordon, Executive Director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, and senior staff to the Governor of Utah here. We've also got Kenny Ellis, who is works for the Office of the Lieutenant Governor in Mississippi. And finally, Senator Gerald Malloy from South Carolina. He's the Judiciary Chair in South Carolina and helped work on the reform efforts in South Carolina. So, well, I'll just start by providing a little bit of context to this conversation, and I know that this is hopefully all old news to you all by now, but I thought it would be useful to just orient us in some of the data findings that brought Pew to this issue several years back. So about 10 years ago, the Pew Charitable Trust started a project called the Public Safety Performance Project. We were interested in this growing trend of incarceration in the country, in the United States, and also the poor returns on investment that states were getting in terms of public safety outcomes. So I'm going to talk about two kind of buckets of trends that we've been focused on in our research and in our technical assistance. And the first is around, as I said, this remarkable growth in the use of prisons and jails. And so by 2008, as many of you may have heard, we were looking at 1 in 100 American adults in jail or prison, 1 in 31 adults under some form of correctional control, and by that we mean jail, prison, probation, parole, supervision. And all growth was coming at fairly extraordinary taxpayer expense. And so in 1997, just less than two decades ago, the state corrections budgets were about $23 billion across the board, and then today they're at $54 billion. So there was a real leap up in the amount of money that states were spending and state taxpayers were spending on prisons and on other correctional programs. All this spending, as I said, was getting a pretty, a low return on investment in terms of recidivism outcomes. And so we looked a little at, okay, for offenders coming out of prison, what is their likelihood to return inside of a year, 2 years, 3 years? And I think that policymakers across the country were alarmed to find that about 40%, over 40% of offenders exiting state prisons were back inside of them inside of 3 years. And this is what we call in criminology a recidivism rate. So these high costs and these low returns have captured the attention, I think you know, of economists, of criminologists, of state policymakers, and that really brings us to the second trend that we've been pretty fascinated with, and that is around, if you don't mind, states looking at this data and interrogating this data and coming up with solutions to head in a different direction, to do more hopefully with less, to make sort of cost-effective choices about who goes to prison, how long they stay, what the outcomes are that they're seeking in terms of recidivism. We actually have a large and robust body of research now in correctional science that helps us understand what works to change offending behavior, and so that research has really been applied to state practices and policies. And what you see here is a really diverse bucket of states pursuing justice reform strategies in across the country. You can see Alaska in the midst of that work right now. And all that work has led to a new trend in terms of the data that we're seeing. So for the first time in 2008, the state prison population began to dip downwards. It's really hard to know now if this is just a momentary decline or if it will sustain, and we certainly hope, because that decline has been accompanied by a crime decline. You know, you've been able to achieve this decline across the board in incarceration and also maintain your crime decline. We're hoping that this getting more public safety for less is a win-win that we'll continue to see over the course of the coming years and decades. So with that context, I'll just say that we've got, as I said, four leaders from four states, very different states, who came to this work for a variety of reasons. And I wanted to just, with your permission, let them each speak a little bit about what brought them to this issue. We have some visuals here to help you understand the kind of trends that they were facing in their states when they rolled up their sleeves and took this on.
Fantastic. And Representative Ledoux.
You know, I'm looking at that graph, and that is absolutely astounding from 1925 to 2008. Is that because we've got more laws on the books? I mean, more things that you can possibly end up in jail for?
It is certainly that. There are a lot more laws on the books. There are also there has been an increase both in the number of laws and in the penalties themselves. And so, you know, as policymakers and different states and also the federal government have both expanded criminal statutes, but also said, okay, for this crime, let's make it a felony instead of a misdemeanor, or an aggravated felony instead of a felony, and let's, you know, move the degrees of class up, or let's change the penalty ranges. All these kinds of enhancements have been happening, and oftentimes, or sometimes certainly, those enhancements have helped, right? So we certainly know that prison does help reduce crime if it's targeted on those serious and violent and repeat offenders that we want to keep incapacitated. It's sort of lower-level offenders for whom prison can actually be criminogenic and can sort of make them more likely to commit future crime. And so those are the kinds of questions that states have been looking at. Do we need quite so many of these laws? Can we look at whether or not they're targeting the right kinds of offenders?
So this might be kind of simplistic, but what do you think would happen if you just, instead of page forwarding, page backward, get into a time capsule and start rewriting the laws to back to where they were in 1925, except or make that the kind of the presumption that that's where they should be, except where you can show that any particular law, any particular aggravator is actually something that makes sense?
Well, I think that that's in some ways, a little bit of what some of these states are doing, not necessarily picking a moment in time and erasing the books and going back to it, but really interrogating again with fresh eyes the kinds of outcomes they're getting from these policies. And so, you know, what I will say is when we really went down this prison building path in the 1970s, one of the reasons I think states went down it is because there was this consensus that nothing worked to change criminal offending behavior, and so if nothing works, let's lock them up. And at the time, that really was where the field of criminology was. We hadn't answered a lot of questions about what can stop crime, what can prevent crime, what kind of policing works, and what kind of policing doesn't work, and what kind of community corrections program work and treatment works. In the intervening several decades, we have a really robust and strong body of research that tells us what does and doesn't work, and so I would just caveat your premise with saying we want to, I think, go back to some of the policies we have before, but we also want to include some of that new research about what works to prevent crime, what works to prevent, you know, reoffending.
Thank you.
Representative Groomer.
Thank you. Ms. Towns, the chart's impressive, but you can't tell there is no scale.
Thank you. We will...
I don't know of what we're dealing with in 1925. The population was a lot less then. And it looks like there was no crime anywhere. Tell us what the scale is. What are we dealing with
Thank
here?
You. You're looking at an incarceration rate right now. But what we know right now is we've got roughly 2.3 million adult Americans behind bars. So that's where we are today in 2013 and continued.
What was it then?
That is a good question that I will follow up with you on. I don't want to venture a guess at 1925, but I can certainly get you that information.
Because in order for us really to figure out this society is nowhere near where it was back then, probably had a lot of bootleggers.
I wanted to ask one question, and then we'll, unless anyone has just one question, which is, looking at it as an overall issue, did you factor in the point at which states began to institutionalize the mentally ill?
That is a wonderful question and a huge part of, I think, the policies that helped to fuel and drive some of this prison growth. We have seen that significant proportions of the offenders who are behind bars now in states and in localities and jails are struggling with mental disorder or mental health disorders. And so there's a pretty big consensus in the research that deinstitutionalization had a big role in prison growth.
I'm thrilled to hear that. I was just at a meeting a couple weeks ago, a round table with lawmakers from Western states, and every one of those states cited that was the largest percentage of those incarcerated were mentally ill in their state. So it's not just an Alaska problem, and the discussion was centered a lot around the fact that we deinstitutionalized the West roughly around the same time and went to community health models, but as our budgets have gone into deficit spending in most of the Western states, we've systematically cut that funding for community health programs. And what you've ended up with as a result is sort of prisons become a de facto institution again for the mentally ill, and unfortunately not backed up then with the kind of training that you would have had in an institution where you know that the people coming through the door suffer from mental illness. And so I'm thrilled to hear that, and I look forward to the folks that are coming up next referencing that as they, you know, as you try to turn these things around, how you address that percentage of the population. Anyone else? Yes, Representative Clayman.
Similarly related to the graph, so the graph is actually a per capita statistic as opposed to a total population, but
exactly.
The other query I'm trying to gauge kind of somewhere about halfway between 25 and 2008 was when you start seeing a significant uptick. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious to know what a couple of years along the line, because whether that's 1970 or 1980 or 1990, I'm kind of interested in knowing, because is there some seminal point in time in which we really start seeing this slope go up?
Yes.
And can you tell us that?
Yes, and it's certainly in the 1970s. There was it started in the 1970s. There's a very steep decline in the 80s and 90s, largely due to the both the federal and the state approach to drug crime. So that's where you see a lot of that leap moving up.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And so next you want to have Jay speak, and then Ron Gordon, Kenny Ellis, and Gerald Malloy. Is that correct?
Okay.
Excellent. And for each of you gentlemen and women that come forward, if you just put your name on the record and how you'd like to be affiliated. And if you can reference which document among the members' packets you're looking at, that also helps us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jay Neal, Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Transition Support and Reentry in Georgia, and served in the state legislature for about 9 years. The slide that you see before you is the slide that shows the prison population in the state of Georgia. When we began our Justice Reinvestment Initiative in 2011, with the assistance of Pew, providing our technical assistance. We had a prison population of roughly 56,000 at that time. One thing that you don't see on that slide is we also had, in addition to the 56,000 in the prison system, we had roughly 6,000 that were in county jails, already having been sentenced to state prison, but we did not have beds for them. They were being housed in the county jails waiting for beds to open up. We were, at that time, spending about $25 million a year for county subsidies to house those inmates that were in the county jails, having already been sentenced to prison. We now have a prison population, actually it's down to about 53,000 today, and the jail backlog has been eliminated. We had, in 2015 fiscal year, we, instead of spending $25 million on jail subsidy, we spent $6,000 on jail subsidies in fiscal year 2015. So in a matter of 3 years, we eliminated that backlog of $6,000. And saved the state roughly $25 million in subsidies for county jails for housing those state sentenced inmates. That's where we are compared to where we were in 2011. But let me give you a little bit of background on what got me involved in this process, and then a little bit of background on what got Georgia started in the criminal justice reform. And I'll share with you a couple of things that I learned, and then I'll be glad to answer questions as well. I yesterday was with Senator Coghill of the National Sentencing Commission, and had an opportunity to hear him share a little bit about his experience leading to his time in the state legislature, and we actually share a lot of things in common. I have a ministerial background. I had never been involved in politics in any way other than voting prior to 2002, when I had someone in my community recruit me to run for state representative. I remember when they asked me, I laughed. Couldn't understand why they were asking me to run for state representative. What I agreed to do in that meeting was I agreed to pray about it, and I went home and told my wife that I had been asked to run for state representative, and she too laughed. I wasn't sure how to take that, but certainly I understood it. And I came from a background where my philosophy and my feeling around addiction and the criminal element was very similar to so many others' views and opinions of the 1980s and 90s and going into 2000, which led to the graph, as you saw, that Zoe presented, the steep incline in incarceration rates in the 80s and 90s. When the federal government passed Truth in Sentencing in the 90s and encouraged and incentivized states to pass three strikes and you're out legislation in the state of Georgia, we said, well, we think we can do better than that. And we passed some two strikes and you're out legislation back in the 90s. While the national rate was 1 in 31 under some form of correctional supervision in Georgia, it was 1 in 13. We continued to move in the direction of incarceration. A lot of people in Georgia refer back to the fact that we were established as a penal colony, and continued in that vein for many, many years. I embraced that, quite frankly. You know, when I ran for state representative, I was careful about my campaign promises. I knew I would be one out of 236 legislators. I didn't want to promise what I would do, realizing one out of 236, but I promised what I worked toward. And I promised I'd work toward better education, a better business environment, and a safer communities to raise our children in. What I believed at that time was that meant that we would continue to move in the direction we were, continuing to incarcerate at a high rate, and if that incarceration was not bringing the results that we needed, maybe we hadn't incarcerated long enough. So that's kind of the background that I had coming in. I think it's ironic, and you mentioned the mental health. Quite frankly, the mental health and the addiction go hand in hand. So many of those are co-occurring who have mental health and substance abuse issues as well. One of the ironic things is when you look at addiction, one of the characteristics of addiction is people will continue to do the same thing over and over again, regardless of the consequences that that action brings. Yet we respond to that addiction by trying to use consequences to change the behaviors. It's quite ironic when you really step back to look at what we're trying to do using consequences to change addictive behavior. One of the things that happened to me over the course of my first few years in the state legislature is the church that I pastored, the small church that I pastored, we had a recovery residence in my community, and men who attended that, who lived in that recovery residence started attending my church. And what I saw in those men who were struggling with addiction was 180 degrees from what I had always believed about addiction. I always wondered why, if they loved their families, why couldn't they just straighten up? And why didn't they go to work and take care of their families and do the right thing? And I couldn't understand their behaviors, and I couldn't understand the neglect. And what I saw in those men was a brokenness. Men who were brokenhearted and big, strong men in tears because of the way it failed their families. And I began to try to struggle with what I had always believed about addiction and what I was now seeing every Sunday morning in my church. I had an opportunity to begin to learn about addiction, the science of addiction, and what it does to the brain. And I began to realize that my approach through the years didn't have any kind of scientific backing to it. And quite frankly, it was that approach that was taking many of these individuals who were not criminally minded. They were behaving criminally as a result of their addiction, either through possession or maybe selling or maybe through stealing or fraud in order to be able to afford their addiction habit. And we were taking those addiction-driven crimes, and we were treating those individuals as if they were criminals. And that kind of mindset, that kind of incarceration of addiction-driven crime was what was leading to the criminogenic factor that Zoe talked about in her presentation. I think we all know that when somebody goes to prison, they change. They don't come back the same person they were when they went in. Quite frankly, many times, especially when we're sending people who don't have a criminal mindset, but they're behaving criminally as a result of their addiction, we send them to prison, they're going to come back worse than they were when they went in because they've been in a criminogenic area. They've been around people with criminal mindsets. They come out with a felony on their record. They've learned how to become criminals in that environment. And quite frankly, they come back to the community worse than they were when they went in. So I began to look at what I needed to do as a representative to try to change the direction of Georgia. I became an advocate for recovery. I actually, and this would have, 15 years ago, if you told me this was the direction I was going, I wouldn't have believed you. In 2009, I became a director of a residential drug treatment program. And for 4 years served as a director of a residential drug treatment program until the governor asked me to serve in this role. When I resigned from the state legislature, and I resigned from that position in order to be the director of the governor's office of transition support and reentry. We began in 2011 with a bill to establish a criminal justice reform council, and we started looking at sentencing and corrections reform. Our governor understands very clearly the need of addressing this population in a different way. He was a former prosecutor. He was a former juvenile court judge. His son is a judge that is a drug court judge in the state of Georgia. And we began looking at how we could take these individuals that are not criminally minded, but they're caught up in addiction-driven crime. How can we provide alternatives for them in order to be able to address, hold them accountable, but to address the thing that's driving the criminal behavior? Quite frankly, when you get an addict in recovery, if they're not criminally minded, the criminal behavior goes away when they get in recovery. So as we begin the criminal justice reform, we changed a number of our sentencing laws. We averted many of these individuals who were involved in drug and property offenses, most of those property offenses being driven by their addiction. We diverted them from the prison system through accountability courts, drug courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, other forms of accountability courts, day reporting centers to give them the treatment and the services they need in the community while holding them accountable in a very rigorous way. Nothing gentle, nothing soft about Georgia's approach. It's a very rigorous program that they go through. And we began our criminal justice reform efforts in 2012 with a legislative package that, and the governor talked about this going in, he wanted consensus. It was interesting. The governor led our reform efforts. Speaker of the House and the Lieutenant Governor and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and myself and the Attorney General, the minority leader of the House and the Senate joined him in a press conference talking about the introduction of the bill to set up the Criminal Justice Reform Council. He began to lead in this direction, and House Bill 1176 passed in 2012 with a unanimous vote in both the House and the Senate. Now, I don't know how hard it is to get unanimous votes in Alaska. It's not an easy thing to do in Georgia, especially if there's anything substantive to that legislation. The governor then turned the attention to juvenile justice reform the following year. We put together a pretty comprehensive legislative package to address juvenile justice reform. And once again, that passed unanimously in both the House and the Senate. Our approach has been comprehensive. We took on sentencing reform for adults. We took on sentencing reform for juveniles. And then the governor said, ultimately, if we're going to really have an impact on what we're trying to do from a state perspective and really a lasting impact, we've got to do more than just reform sentencing. We also have to deal with those who are involved in the prison system and coming out. About 21,000 individuals each year leave the Georgia prison system and return home to their community. What are we doing with those who are coming home to ensure that they're successful in their return? So year three, the council began to look. And by the way, in the second year, the council was codified for a five-year term, and the governor gave it the assignment of looking at reentry. Created the governor's Office of Transition Support and Reentry to manage a collaborative effort among all departments and agencies as we move forward in our reentry efforts. Working collaboratively with the communities, realizing that this is a community issue, a community problem, it's going to have community involvement to resolve that. So in 2014, we passed legislation beginning our Georgia Prison Reentry Initiative and focusing on what we do with the Prison Reentry Initiative. The council continues to look at our adult reforms and juvenile reforms. We have committees that continue to look at oversight and measuring the outcomes of our reforms, while other committees are now looking toward reentry. By the way, the 2015 reform did not receive unanimous support. It did in the Senate, but in the House there were three members who voted no. Ultimately, all three of those members were Republicans, part of our party, the governor's party, and there's retribution that came along with that, but it didn't come from the governor, it came from the voters. Of those three who voted no, two of them lost in the Republican primary in the following election. So I believe the voters even understand the value that we're receiving with our reform efforts in the state of Georgia. I'll be happy to share with you anything else about what we're doing. I think that's an overview of our efforts to kind of give you an idea of how comprehensive they are. I would submit to you that this is a holistic approach that doesn't have a silver bullet. It has been data-driven from the very beginning with the technical assistance by Pew. Zoe was actually there with us when we started this. And it has been data-driven from the very beginning. It continues to be data-driven, and one of our responsibilities in our office is to ensure that the justice reinvestment savings are being utilized on evidence-based community-centered programs. And quite frankly, the governor has made significant investments. Even before we began seeing any investments that first year, we put $17 million new dollars into to some of these community efforts before we saw any kind of savings at all. But it's a holistic approach with no silver bullet. It's a comprehensive, data-driven approach, collaborative effort with all departments and agencies and community stakeholders working together to move forward in a data-driven approach. I'll be quiet there and allow you to ask some questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony, Mr. Neal. I have just one question, and then I'll turn to members. You mentioned that you have altered your approach to those that have addiction, and then you stated that it's still a very severe penalty, and it's a process that's hard that they have to go through. Would you be willing to describe that a little bit more for the committee members?
So there are a number of things that we did to try to get an opportunity for those individuals who are caught in those drug and property crimes. We found that, if I remember correctly, it's about 5,000 or 6,000 each year that were going to prison for the first time in the state of Georgia that were nonviolent drug and property offenders. Those are the individuals that we're trying to give opportunities, whether it's through the accountability courts or day reporting centers, to be able to address the addiction that's driving that criminal behavior. One of the things that we learned when we began to look at our accountability courts is many of the accountability courts were cherry-picking who they were putting into the accountability courts, and they were bringing people into the accountability courts that were low-risk and low-need offenders because they wanted to make sure they had successes, right? So Matt, we know based on best practices, if you bring those low-risk, low-needs offenders into that kind of setting, quite frankly, offenders who probably would be okay anyway, and you bring them into a rigorous accountability court setting, you increase the risk of those individuals. So we adopted some standards for our accountability courts. We now are targeting the moderate and high-risk and high-needs offenders for accountability courts. We've seen the number of accountability courts increase in the state of Georgia, where now we have over 100 of those accountability courts. For most of those accountability courts, it's a two-year process. They meet regularly with the staffing team. They're held accountable. They're drug tested on a regular basis. They're required to get jobs. There's a pretty lengthy and detailed process that they go through in those 2 years. We give them opportunities if they complete that accountability court. We give them opportunities to be able to do so without having criminal records impacted by their interaction with the court system upon successful completion. So we've done some things to deal with those collateral consequences as well. We're not where we need to be with collateral consequences, I can tell you that, but we've made some significant progress and we're moving in the right direction to deal with those issues as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of related to your question, but it sounds like the accountability courts are your lead diversion tactic. Are there, have you found any contractors, providers that come in and offer treatment programs that work? And if you have, is there a shortage of them? And would you give just a general description of those that seem to work the best, and how do you evaluate those?
So our accountability courts work with community service providers. There's the criminal justice element of those accountability courts clearly, but most of the treatment that's provided through accountability courts is provided by community service providers who are contracting with those accountability courts. Do we have all the community service providers that we need? No, we absolutely don't. One of the conversations that we've had fairly recently is what can we do to provide more access to those community service providers and to increase the availability of those community service providers. One of the areas where we really saw that need was on the juvenile justice side. We found that if I remember correctly, and there's so many numbers, but I think it's 25% of all of those juveniles that were receiving out-of-home placements were misdemeanors or status offenses, meaning that if they were 21, it wouldn't be an offense. And about 25% of those receiving out-of-home placements were those low-level misdemeanors and status offenses. So we created a grant program for those communities. We found also that many of those communities did not have evidence-based community center programs for juveniles. Evidence shows us that those juveniles receiving their services in the community are far more likely to be successful. So we set up a grant-funded program for those circuits and invited the counties to apply for grants. And what they had to do in exchange for receiving the grant was they had to agree to reduce the number of commitments in their county by 15%. In the first year, the counties that received those grant funds and used those funds to improve the access to community evidence-based community programs for juveniles, they reduced the number of out-of-home commitments by 62% in the first year. Not 15%, 62%. In just over a year, we now have evidence-based community-centered programs in every judicial circuit for those juveniles. So we're doing some things to increase access, but we're nowhere near where we need to be. We're much better off than we were 5 years ago, but we're not where we need to be yet. And quite frankly, one of the things that I think we've learned in Georgia is that criminal justice reform, all of these efforts, it's not just a one-shot policy change approach. You can't go in and make some policy changes in 1 year and believe that that's going to take care of all your efforts going forward. We're in our fifth year now. We continue to press forward with a lot of zeal. We're making new recommendations each year. We've got a great deal of support from our legislature. The public opinion has shifted tremendously in the state of Georgia, and we continue to push forward each year knowing that we've got a long ways to go, and every year we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we're better this year than we were last.
Representative Ledoux. Is mandatory treatment, is that something that is always or almost always part of the deal?
If you go to an accountability court, you're going to have mandatory treatment. There are times where offenders choose to go to prison instead of go through the accountability court. I've seen that happen. It doesn't happen very often. I have seen that happen. Or after a certain period of time through the accountability court, they just say, go ahead and put me in prison. It's rigorous. It's not easy. Those who complete the process, though, you'll hear them over and over again talk about how accountability court saved my life. Accountability court reunited my family. Accountability court gave me a new lease on life. So we're having some incredible results from it, but it is rigorous. Mandatory treatment is a part of that. And sometimes you find offenders that, quite frankly, don't want to pay the price of having to go through that. It's rare, but it sometimes happens.
Representative Ledoux. So what exactly, give me an example of a sentence that accountability court would impose, this rigorous sentence.
Most of our accountability courts are pre-adjudication, so it's part of a plea agreement that allows an individual to choose the accountability court in order to be able to avoid the conviction. Some are post-adjudication, and some, quite frankly, end up in accountability court after they served, and they come back and they struggle under parole or probation. But the majority of them are pre-adjudication. It gives them an opportunity to be able to deal with their addiction. Remember, many of those who are coming into our prison system are coming as a result of addiction-driven crime. So those individuals who have high-risk, high needs, they're given the opportunity to go through that typically two-year process where there's staffing on a weekly basis. They meet with their treatment team. The treatment team, probation officer and judge meet together as well weekly to take a look at where they are and the progress they're making, areas where they need to improve. It's a very, very intense process. One of the things we also find in our accountability courts is those participants in the accountability courts become a community. There's a great deal of camaraderie that is established between the members of the community court, of the accountability court. I've seen at graduations where others who are not yet ready to graduate are the ones who are the ones closest to the graduate, supporting them and providing accountability as well to help them, in their success. So it's a great opportunity to provide some of that peer accountability as well.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out, you're using the term rigorous, and then I'm hearing it sounds like they show up once a week and talk to their probation officer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What exactly do they have to do which is rigorous?
There's each individual receives an individual plan based on their own risk and needs. So the kind of programming that they're going to receive will be determined based on their risk and needs. Some of them, the programming they're going to receive may amount to an intensive outpatient substance abuse counseling, for example. Others could have something that's a little bit less restrictive. Some of them may have some substance abuse counseling. They may also have some mental health. So it's not going to be, it's not a one-size-fits-all. I think any time you look at individuals who are caught up in the criminal justice system and you try to have a one-size-fits-all or this is the approach you're going to take with every single one of them, I think you really restrict the opportunities to be successful. So it's important, and Georgia has a very complex and detailed assessment that shows very clearly what those risks and needs are. If they need educational opportunities, those will be provided. If they need job skills or all of those things are components that could be a part of that accountability court process, and it's set up based on those individual needs.
When we heard our committee earlier in the session, there's a little bit of a diversion program that's here in Alaska. And to me, what I thought was rigorous about it is that you're asking someone to give up their addiction and to rehabilitate themselves. And that's what came through for me, was the fact that you had morning and evening drug or alcohol testing that you had to show up for, that you had to make a commitment to your family and your life that you were going to no longer be addicted to whatever the substance is that you're addicted to. So to me, that's what, when you started out by saying, some of these offenders say, I'd rather just go to jail. That rings true with what we were hearing in the Alaska program, is that for those that do commit to it, it's a pretty high success rate, but it's a big commitment.
And for some of them, quite frankly, it involves changing friends. It involves changing there's so many things that have to be changed. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so successful. It's a holistic approach to the overall need of the individual.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm going to call forward the next three together on a panel, if that's okay. And that way, and give each of you a chance. So Ron Gordon, Kenny Ellis, and Gerald Malloy. And if you'd each just put your name on the record, in this way, each of you, for sure, I'd love to hear, you know, your opening statements, if you will. But this way, members have an opportunity to ask. There might be a question they want to ask all three of you. So if you just start and put your name on the record and how you'd like to be affiliated on the record.
I'm Kenny Ellis, and I work for the Lieutenant Governor in Mississippi.
I'm Ron Gordon. I'm with the Utah Governor's Office. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor on Criminal Justice Matters, and I'm the Executive Director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice.
I'm Gerald Malloy. I serve in the South Carolina Senate, and I've been in the Senate since 2002, and I was the chairman of the Senate's Reform Commission.
Excellent. Welcome. And so whoever would like to start,
So when we first looked at this whole process, criminal justice reform, Mississippi actually had the second highest incarceration rate in the country.
Wow.
We were spending astronomical amounts of money on the Mississippi Department of Corrections, and we were simply not getting a good return on investment. In the 10 years prior to the enactment of our reforms, appropriations had gone up nearly 50%. I think it was 48%, despite only having a 4% raise in inmate population. So it was incredibly disproportionate to what other agencies were seeing, in what other states were seeing, quite frankly. That being said, we had to do something to change. Mississippi is a very conservative state. For the most part, everybody is elected in the Republican primary. And honestly, it's a little bit of a taboo for a Republican or a conservative to be looking at these issues. But when we started looking at how we could approach this stuff, we did see Georgia, with their conservative leadership, actually approaching this, and we thought this is something that we probably need to get outside the box a little bit. When we started doing that, we realized that the more you dig into it, the more conservative philosophies apply to it. We're doing better return on investment. We're trying to be frugal. We're trying to get the best results for our taxpayer money. After that, we have, through our reforms, we've been able to cut the budget by anticipated $266 million, which would roughly cover our MDOC appropriation for 1 year. And we can also now predict what our budgets will be as we move forward. Before our reforms, we were unable to predict what our yearly appropriation would be. We would appropriate somewhere in the ballpark of $300 million to MDOC, and routinely they would come back and require another $50, $60 million. So with that instability, we could not accurately project our next fiscal year budgets for MDOC, Department of Health, or anything relying from general fund dollars. So that is where we started this, and we worked through it. We were able to get consensus on the bill and pass it, and I think we're down about 4,000 in prison inmate population since the reforms were enacted in July of last year.
Excellent. Could I just ask a question briefly? You mentioned that I appreciate you giving the political context, that for conservatives to look at this issue, initially there was, concern about how it would be viewed by voters. So I appreciate you talking about that. In evaluating some of the principles, where did the value of human life and rehabilitating the person that has served their time and society has chosen to forgive, did that ever enter? And I just haven't heard a lot of that, and I'd love to hear as we go down the line. We're talking a lot about costs, and that's important. Obviously, that's what we do in the legislative bodies. We look at the cost, but I'd like to hear a little bit also about some of the policy considerations surrounding human life.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's just the other side of the coin. From the policy perspective, from the insider baseball, any nameless, faceless agency will be looked at from a monetary perspective, but with Department of Corrections and Incarceration, we are dealing with human lives. We're dealing with primarily young individuals that may have slipped up, they may have had problems with, you can't ever tell how somebody may react to a drug. It's genetic sometimes. Sometimes it flips the switch. Sometimes it doesn't. But our goal is to go ahead and truly correct the individuals that come into the Department of Corrections. We want them to come in, get the help they need, serve their time, and when they get out, we want them to stay out. And we want them to be productive members of society, and we hope that they contribute back to the state of Mississippi.
Excellent. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Senator, I'm going to start with the last question that you answered, and then I'll go back and talk about how Utah became involved in this. Once we established our set of recommendations, we knew that we had a couple of different policies to discuss. One was that we could save some money by implementing good policy recommendations and maintain, if not improve, public safety. The other was we could improve lives of people in the state of Utah. We weren't sure which one would be more persuasive. In fact, I figured that the fiscal savings would be more persuasive, and that was what I was prepared to discuss primarily with our policymakers as we were having one-on-one meetings. And I found just the opposite to be true. Once our policymakers had data to give them some level of comfort that we were going to maintain public safety, the dialogue shifted then really to human lives. And I'll share one story. I was in the office of a member of House Majority Leadership, and I began explaining our policy recommendations, which in large part dealt with nonviolent offenders, particularly those that had substance use disorders, and explained the need for greater, more effective treatment so that we could avoid the repeat crimes. We could avoid this cycle of crimes. And this representative said, "I know all about that because I have a business that has been broken into repeatedly by a criminal with a drug addiction, and I'm tired of this person breaking in to my business repeatedly." And I thought, this is where it falls apart. We've just lost them. I need to back up and get back on track. And he said, and what this man needs is treatment so that he can change his life and won't have this cycle of addiction as well as this cycle of crime. And it was great. I knew that we had made a significant step forward because we were talking not just about the number of prison beds, not just about their criminal justice system budget, but we were also talking about actually saving lives, both of those who had the addiction and others who didn't have an addiction but were impacted by crime. And so that was a good thing to see. By the end of our legislative session, and we're new to this, we just passed our bill this year, this legislative session. By the end of our legislative session, our justice reinvestment bill was the darling of the session. Everybody wanted to claim that their bill had something to do with justice reinvestment because it had so much momentum, everyone wanted to jump on that bandwagon. And we were flattered. Not all of the claims were entirely accurate. But it was nice to see that there was a change, there was a willingness to discuss different policies, and it came in large part because of the data and the research that gave policymakers some level of assurance that we were headed in a good direction. That data and that research, the data was all Utah-specific. We could not have done what we did without the assistance of the Pew Charitable Trust, the Crime and Justice Institute, Bureau of Justice Assistance. I tell everybody, we have a lot of smart people in Utah. We needed the assistance of Pew to help us do what we did. We came to it from a little bit different perspective. We felt pretty good about the situation we were in. Utah has a fairly low incarceration rate, about half of the national average, and we thought we were doing great. We have, over the years, avoided some of the criminal justice policy pitfalls that have been a thorn in the side for other states, and we didn't see the need for significant comprehensive reform. We knew that we had some problems that we needed to work on. We weren't sure that comprehensive reform. And so at that time, when I would see the map that Zoe put up that had the different color shading for different states, we'd say, well, we don't need to be a blue state because we don't have all the problems that all those other JRI states had. Now I take great pride in the fact that we are shaded as a state that has engaged in this justice reinvestment. We began discussions about relocating our main prison facility. It's a 4,000-bed facility. It's an aging facility, and it's located on land that is very, very valuable. Its highest and best use is no longer to house inmates. The highest and best use it involves other things, particularly a technology center. So we've engaged in this dialogue, and we heard policymakers saying, if we're going to relocate this 4,000-bed prison facility, and if we know that we're going to need to incarcerate more people in the future, why don't we just capitalize on economies of scale, the good workforce, and the good price of raw materials, and build a 6,000-bed facility? And then somebody said, well, if 6 is good, 8,000 is better. And as I mentioned to those in attendance at the Sentencing Commission conference yesterday, when somebody recommended that we just build out for the future and have a 10,000-bed facility, we got really, really nervous because we were going from 4,000 to 10,000, and we knew if we did that, we would fill those beds, and we would look back and say, how did we get to this point? The governor called for a comprehensive review of criminal justice policies. My office was charged with that task, and we had the Pew Charitable Trust assist us in that effort. And I won't go into all of the recommendations now. I can share some of them with you later if you're interested. But we found that 2/3 of our prisoners were there for probation revocations or parole revocations. These are people that at one point we thought would continue to be safe in our communities, and they were in prison. And they were not there for committing new crimes, most of them. They were there for technical violations. We were tired of dealing with them. We ignored technical violations for a few times, and then on the 9th violation, we'd say, we don't know what to do with you, so we're going to send you to prison. We were failing them, and we were failing our state by not supervising them appropriately. Many of our recommendations deal with improving community supervision, strengthening community supervision, and ending that cycle of recidivism. We found that we were incarcerating people longer and longer, and that was not an intentional decision. That was a surprise. We found that we were incarcerating low-level drug offenders longer and longer, people who did not have a criminal history. They did not have prior felony convictions. They were sentenced to prison, and we held them longer. We kept telling people that it takes a lot to get to prison in the state of Utah. And we were a little embarrassed when we found out that that's not always the case, that some of our drug offenders go with zero or one prior felony. So the data was not always pleasant to receive, but it was important to receive, and it was the foundation for everything that we did.
Wonderful. Thank you. Senator?
Good afternoon. It's good to be here. Thank you all for having us. Madam Chairperson, I sit in your seat in South Carolina. I've been there since 2002. I want to tell you, first of all, that I'm a lawyer. I'm a Democrat from a rural area. South Carolina only has 4.6 million people. We represent about 100,000 people per senator.
Okay.
We have 46 senators in the South Carolina State Senate. 28 are Republican, majority party, 18 are Democrat. As you all know, we lost one of our members who was my sweet mate in a very fatal shooting here just a month and a half ago, right at 2 months ago. He was my sweet mate. I was his lawyer. I still represent his family. Was a sweetheart of a man, and worked really hard on this reform measures. We have 124 members in the House of Representatives. Probably almost two-thirds of those are in the majority party Republican. We have Republicans in all of our constitutional officers in our state, from the governor all the way down to the Department of Agriculture chief. So in 2006, they asked me to chair a criminal justice task force, which was to look at some criminal matters that we needed on the books. What we found was is that we needed to go into Senate reform and did not have enough time. So we then established the Senate Reform Commission. Candidly, I thought it was a setup whenever they asked me to chair, because I thought it was an opportunity to let people out of prison and they needed a scapegoat. And so I was reluctant. But what I do know is this. I've been married now for 26 years. I have four beautiful children, and obviously it's important for me to keep my community safe. And if you don't have your community safe, then you can't have good educational matters. You can't have economic development. It's an imperative. And when we first started, we had a group similar to yours here in the General Assembly. I know exactly what's going through your head. And basically, I would tell you a good South Carolina story. There is a boxer that's by the name of Joe Frazier. Some of you may be old enough to remember Joe Frazier, who had a great fight with Muhammad Ali. And there were some fighters during that time, Ken Norton and Jimmy Young and others that were just fantastic. And Joe Frazier once said, he said, "Jimmy Young is the smartest fighter I ever fought in my life." So he was a great thinker in the ring. He's thinking of every which way and everything that you can happen in a fight. He said, "And you know what? The whole while he was thinking, I was hitting him." And so sometimes what we have to do is make sure that we can solve the problems that we can solve. And so this is a problem-solving mechanism. What we had in South Carolina, I see Zoe has put this chart up. I'm not going to bore you with all of these statistics. I'll just tell you this, is that, number one, the war on drugs just did not work. We incarcerated too many people, and you all see the results of it now. And we continue to end up doing it, and you know, and you've hit on it, and this is down the road, because what you got is that the treatment issues are exactly what you want to do. I'll just tell you that South Carolina, in 2010, when we came out with our legislation, we were about 25,000. The chart says 24,600. It was a little bit higher by the time that we had ended up getting to our measure, and we were projected to go up to 28,000 in the next 5 years, which would have been 2014 last year. I report to you today that we have 20,500 folks in our Department of Corrections, so we're down 4,500. Here's what's more important to us during that time, is that we've closed 2.5 prisons, and so that's real savings. What we've done is that there's a lot of measures that we've done. We had several goals. We got the judiciary involved, which from our Supreme Court to the Court of Appeals to the Circuit Court. The House of Representatives was also involved. The governor's office was also involved. We had four prongs to our legislation. And I just tell you this, the approach was just simple. You know, we have enough food in the world to feed the world, but we don't have enough accesses to get to all of the people. And so the issue becomes is that you do what you can do, because we had a lot of things in our bill that we, what the things in our commission that we wanted to pass and did not, because we had to reach consensus. Well, all the stakeholders in. I probably know the least about sentence reform of anybody that was on my committee, because I had to manage the committee. Had Republicans and Democrats, and what we decided to do was this. We took the P out of politics and put it into people. It wasn't partisan. We wanted to make sure that we can get a product that can work. And like Georgia did, we passed it unanimously in the South Carolina Senate, and we only had 4 no votes in the South Carolina House of Representatives. Our 4 prongs were this, and I read those. We're adopting common sense sentencing reforms, improving release policies, strengthening parole and probation, and establishing an ongoing oversight committee, which I also chair. And that oversight committee had a 5-year sunset. I had a strong law enforcement people on my committee. Whenever he was on my committee, he was a lifelong police officer. I put him in charge of release mechanisms. Then we went down to our prisons. We could see what was going on, where we have the senior folks and those folks that we thought that were becoming more docile. There's a method for a release of them. I just tell you that we end up changing our Schedule I drugs. We actually made ways so that we could have conditional discharge. We put administrative matters on them. We increased the numbers on the property crimes. But you know what happened was this. We brought everybody to the table so that they could end up having a voice. The persons that we did not forget about was the victims. We made sure that we expanded restitution, increased the amounts that they could end up getting, expanded the time. And so what you have is that you have a conglomerate of people like this in a committee. You'll end up coming up, and everyone has an angle where they want to end up approaching it. Here's what we found out in South Carolina in our system that we had. We had no system. We come in on a Monday or Tuesday morning from the General Assembly, and it depends on what happened in your personal life, whenever you went home on the weekend and you heard from a constituent, and then you put a piece of legislation in. There was no system as it relates to it. We took out some of the mandatory minimums. We end up doing a lot of matters as it relates to probation and parole, with the other parts of release. We can go into the details to end up showing you how it ended up happening. I'm 5 years out now. My governor at the time was Congressman Mark Sanford. Congressman Mark Sanford signed my bill in 2010. I never forget his words during that time. He said, this is probably the most important piece of legislation that I signed while I was governor. And you know that he had some challenging times then. He's been reelected. He's very conservative. But he said, you know what? You won't know the results of it until 20 years later. And so we're 5 years out now. We're down to 20,500, where we would have been, as you see that statistic, 27,903. And so that's where we were going. We have our oversight. We have 35% of our savings that we can have that we should be reinvesting. Obviously, I heard some talk about mental health and mental issues. You know, that is within the system that where the Department of Corrections will end up working, a problem that they can end up solving and helping. What you're having is at least that we have the drug courts. We are actually working toward that. So technically, we're down about 7,500 from where we were from a state that's our size. And so what you have to do, I think, during the time is to see where you want to go. There's no one-size-fits-all. In my state, we have about 30% African-Americans. I would tell you, as an African-American, that it's reprehensible and immoral the way that we incarcerate African-American males. And then some folks will say, well, tell us why that is. Well, we need your help. And so basically what we have to do is when you have segments of the population, whenever you don't have the training and the diversity within the law enforcement community to end up growing, you have certain results. I'm not a person that can explain it all. I can just tell you what the results are. But basically what we're doing is that we're seeing that going down. And the big news is that our crime rates have gone down in the same time that our prison population has gone down in a significant level. And so I'd be glad to provide you with other information as we go along, and happy to end up answering your questions. Thank you. We've enjoyed being here in Alaska.
Thank you very much, Sir Malloy. What we will be interested in, and I assume that obviously the P Trust will work on it, But the diversity training element, as I mentioned in the first part of the hearing, one of the concerns I hear, and I think other members hear, about those that are incarcerated is the disproportionate number of African Americans and the disproportionate number of Alaska Natives compared to their population they represent in Alaska as a whole. And so we do want to get to the bottom of that. One question I have for you, reaching back to the corrections part, were there elements of your package that included training for corrections officers and in identifying mental health issues and those types of things, or rehabilitation for those incarcerated in a hard prison, that have changed any of the numbers?
No, we actually, this is a bill that we put together in a Senate session. What we did was is that for a person that was serving a period of time, we had issues where they would max out their sentence without going in and getting some supervision. We had a requirement for supervision for one that was having period of incarceration for 2 years. For those that were serving a year, we were giving compliance credits whenever they came out with the probation, pardon, parole. We also had an issue with administrative sanctions, where we had about a quarter of our folks that were going incarcerated were going back into the prison because of those technical violations. And so I think what I hear you saying is that if we address that in the bill, that is in the operation model from the Department of Corrections. I think that the philosophy was that we're going to save them money. We have to be able to end up having programs yes. that will be able to help it. The warehousing issue is not the issue that's going to be able to help you. It's the programming issues that is within the department that's going to help you. And if you can end up saving money, because I know that we don't want to talk about the financial aspect. If you save money, you're going to have more money to operate and put your programs together. And so if you are able to end up allocating resources, because that's what the politics is about. By definition, is how you allocate your resources. If you're going to allocate resources to end up putting it there, then you're going to be better off. You have to determine whether or not that you are a rehabilitative and repentant society, or whether you're going to be a lock-em-up society. And if you're going to be a lock-em-up society, you just have to pay for it.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, may I add that the Utah package does address that issue of providing additional assistance to those with mental health disorders, both in the community as well as in the prison facility. A fundamental part of our package is making sure that everybody who comes into the criminal justice system has an evidence-based screen and an evidence-based assessment so that we can identify their specific needs. We were really treating crimes, not people. So we would say, you're a third-degree felony property offender, here's what you need. You're a second-degree felony sex offender, here's what you need. We were not adequately saying, here are your specific needs and risk factors. And so our package now makes it clear that that happens. We are assessed and appropriated additional funds to provide those types of interventions, both in the community and within the prison facility. It mandates the development of standards for treatment, which is not something that we've had before. And if any provider wants to receive state funds, they have to now be a certified provider and meet these minimum standards.
Excellent. I'll be curious to look at that. Fantastic. Questions from other members of the committee? Yes. Representative Grunberg and then Representative Keller.
Senator.
Yes, sir.
I gather you're a Democrat?
I am. I said that in the beginning.
And you said it's a very small minority of Democrats, but they put you in charge of the committee. Was that unusual?
I would think that it would be relatively unusual when you have a system like my system in South Carolina, where we're a majority-based system instead of a seniority system, to end up putting a Democrat from a rural community. But I do believe that my body is more of a meritocracy, where hard work will pay dividends. And I think that what happens is that if you have individuals that will minimize themselves and elevate their body to try to get to something for the greater good, I think that that was a challenge. And I think that the reason that the partisanship was taken off the table was because it was research-driven, it was evidence-based, and the facts matter. And if you would stick to the facts, then you have a uniform ability to take it to the public to say, this is the problem that we have in our state, and this is how you can address these problems, and that's uniform. So this is not a political win for any particular party. So if you think you can do it for, on a partisanship basis, regardless, I don't know the numbers here, then you have to make certain that you stay true to the research. And what we were able to do is to make certain, for example, in South Carolina, our systems with the Department of Corrections and Probation, Pardon and Parole, and the court system, they weren't even on the same data system. I don't quite understand it, but we were able to get it together to find out what the drivers were in our system. Here's one that will make some sense to you. The third most incarcerated crime in the state of South Carolina, believe it or not, was driving under suspension, non-DUI related.
Wow.
Because when you get involved in that cycle, we had a mandatory sentence after the third offense. Well, whenever you're in poverty or you don't have money and you get driven in that area, then you had a six-month prison term. And what we also found was is that 44% of the individuals that were incarcerated in the state of South Carolina, they were nonviolent and were in prison for less than 18 months. So we are using prison beds to incarcerate those individuals. And so the other crimes were like forgery and checks and those kind of matters and burglary twos, which they were negotiating down. And so I know that we put a lot of focus on mental health, and that's always an issue. But those were not mental health issues. Those were issues where I think Newt Gingrich said it well whenever he put his publication, which they have our little handout here, is that, you know, a lot of people, you're supposed to be locking up people that are bad or that are doing things in South Carolina. You filled up with people that you're just mad at.
Yeah.
And so what we have to do is to make certain that, one, that those individuals that we can rehabilitate and we can turn them in from tax burdens into taxpayers. And so if we can have those that we have that are incarcerated, that we can end up turning from tax burdens to taxpayers, it makes for a better society. And I get back and say that the mental illness issue is an issue that we have to address in South Carolina. But what we found is that we've saved substantial funds during the time. And so our correction system was operating from a deficit. They're not now. We have more money in the system. But what we do recognize is this, the fact that we're incarcerating the violent individuals in our system now. The cost for incarcerating a violent person goes up some. Okay? But when you're closing prisons, you're also saving it. And if you're getting more money into the operating budget for the Department of Corrections, then they're able to put more programs in to end up handling those mental health issues and can end up making certain that they can report back to the assembly. We can do more expansion with drug courts and those kind of rehabilitative things that we need to end up doing.
Excellent. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to try to say something I think that probably would be said by everybody on the committee, but it's not wasted on us how many years of experience that you're bringing to us today, and all four of you from four states over a long period of time with the help and the input of Pew. I'm personally very impressed, and I'm sure that, you know, I'm speaking for others on the committee, and, I just wanted to say that deep gratitude. Actually, Jay, when he was up here, this is leading to a question, made a statement, I believe, that reform isn't the kind of thing that you all of a sudden we've arrived and we don't have to mess with anymore. So we're at the stage, okay, where we're trying to get there. We're behind you all. What have you found that you have had to go back and address, that took more attention, more prodding, and continues to, and did you build anything into your reform process to keep the reform going? It's kind of a broad question, and I'm not directing anyone in particular.
So our bill was House Bill 585, and primarily the things that we had to, in the past, in the 2014 regular session, this past session in 2015, we did have to make a couple of small rewordings more than anything, but that's really all it was. There was no policy mistakes. For the most part, it was just a matter of interpretation of the actual language in the bill. That being said, we did, in the original bill, set up an oversight task force that will constantly be monitoring both the data and the policies as we move forward in this whole operation. They have been meeting throughout the summer. Our Department of Corrections has been compiling data, and outside of that, we also have a separate reentry council, which is headed up by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Mississippi and also by a federal judge in Mississippi. So we've got a couple of things moving forward, but absolutely, this is not something that, you know, we can raise a flag and say, yes, we did it, and I'm so proud of myself, and be done with it. This is an ongoing expense.
Because we're so new, we don't have years of data to report on. We anticipated that there would be additional things that we would need to address, and so we did two primary things. One, our justice reinvestment report identified some areas that needed further attention that were not ready to include in our JRI bill. So we essentially bound ourselves saying, here are three areas that need attention. We can't put them in this year, but we will study them next year, and we are currently studying those items right now. And like Mississippi, we established an oversight group. It's my commission. We are responsible for tracking every data point that can be tracked and reporting back to the legislature. Most of our bill doesn't even take effect until October 1st, and the legislature is already writing a brief on what has happened since they passed the bill in March. And so they are very much on top of monitoring this, expecting results, and we are charged with delivering those results and then reporting why or why not.
Thank you. Many of the folks that have heard me speak on this and in all the times I've been all over, including some of these other states, have heard me tell the story before. It was the story that Wayne Gretzky told the interviewer that time when they asked him what makes you great. And he was very sheepishly said, you know, some people skate to where the puck is, I skate to where it's going. And Representative Kelly, you're trying to see where this puck is going, and that's the perfect question. What we did was we set up a Senate Oversight Committee as well. And basically, we had a five-year sunset because we had folks that were not sure how it would work. What we do now is that if someone files a criminal bill that would have a penalty in it, then we are supposed to end up going to our fiscal office to see what the impact is on the prison system. Let's keep in mind that, too, in South Carolina, the judges in South Carolina are elected by the legislature. We have a judicial merit selection committee. We do not have guidelines. And so we want to make certain that we give them the flexibility. So what we did was when we were going around talking to them, I did a presentation to the judges. I'll do one again this coming Friday. And so what we tell them is that as our judges, we are entrusted to you that we are not giving you mandatory minimums. And so we don't have mandatory minimums. We've taken a lot of them out. And so if someone puts a bill in now that has a mandatory minimum, we know that our state is not one size fit all. We got to entrust our judges to end up making the right decision on those matters. And I try to act as a gatekeeper. So if any time that someone puts a mandatory minimum bill in that doesn't have the requisite amount of study on it, doesn't show me the prison impact, then it shows the impact that we think it would be financially. I make it my business to try to put it on the contested calendar so we can see where it actually goes. Our oversight committee has been going on for 5 years. We're just in the process of renewing it. We look at our risk assessment issues. Our parole board has come back and appeared in front of us. We're looking at the numbers now as to what happened, how many folks are being released, tell us what's going on. We're trying to put the models together as to the variable cost and the marginal cost as it relates to the those that are incarcerated, so we can see what our cost avoidance is. And based upon our legislation, we have a 35% model where whatever we save, we recommend it back to the General Assembly so that they can end up putting it in the budget, try to put it back into supervision, because if you are going to end up having more folks on supervision, you're going to have to invest in it. And as you know, when you start dealing with the financial aspect, you're dealing with another 170 people each time. Reasonable people do disagree. But I think what's happening is that we're going in the right direction. It's not perfect. I wish we would have gone further. I'm not exactly certain how, but I think that there's a lot of other low-hanging fruit that you're able to end up getting on a lot of this legislation, particularly on the drug crimes, particularly on treatment matters, particularly on conditional discharges. I'm not certain what your pretrial intervention is, but if you look at what you have as far as cost avoidance, we can look now and see that we've had a Clemson study, which is the other school that's in my state,
yes,
on the financial impact, and it goes all the way down to the number of children that were not placed in foster care based upon this bill. So there's a lot of work that can be done. There's a lot of assistance can be provided from all around, but it takes buy-in from each and every person there to make sure that they do it evidence-based, based on the research, so you can end up getting a product. And I tell you, I'll conclude on this. My friend Tim Scott, who serves in the United States Senate, had dinner with me the other night. He said, tell me how a conservative can end up supporting this Senate reform, because they're taking it on in the United States House of Representatives and Senate now. Just based on the facts, how can you argue against it? So you got to find the drivers in your own state. And South Carolina, as you know, we don't operate the way other states do. We do it our own way. When we come together, there are folks that say, this is South Carolina, this is how we want to do it, and so you got to find the issues that work for your state. It doesn't have to work the way my state works or any other state. It has to work for your state.
Wonderful. Representative Ledoux, and then Representative Klayman, and then we'll wrap up and go to the next. But this is wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, this is for Senator Malloy. So your observation that a significant portion of your prison population was made up of poor people who were doing things, had traffic-related things, like driving under a suspension, where they couldn't pay to get unsuspended, so that basically the prisons were functioning almost as a state debtor's prison. Was this something that people actually didn't know until the Pew Foundation came in? I mean, can every state maybe expect some surprise like this, or is this something that people actually knew about beforehand?
You know, there's this great thing called political will that a lot of times we legislators don't have in my state. I'm not sure about your state.
Never in our state.
And so I think that sometimes you could recognize a problem and no one did anything about it because they didn't want the appearance of being soft on crime. And even though that, because the public sometimes would not necessarily understand it, but once we had the package put together, basically, if you're going to have a person that is not DUI related, why can't we give them the opportunity for monitoring? And so that then we don't have to end up paying for it, and they can pay for their own monitoring. If they have traffic tickets that's outstanding and they're not able to reinstate, why not put an amnesty period together? That's what we did to allow them to end up doing it. If you can't pay it all at one time, put an installment program together so we could do it based on an installment. If you got a bus that lets folks out of jail on a particular day and give them a ticket to nowhere, and then they're out there in the yonder in South Carolina, as we end up calling it, we made DMV make certain they could issue them a photo identification so that they could end up at least going and applying for jobs and that kind of stuff whenever they got out. It's the small things like that were mattering. And so individuals, yes, I think they would know that, but the statistics didn't bear out because we had never done a study to put those statistics together. And when we saw the statistics, you know, it was a no-brainer to everyone that was watching and say, are you serious? The third most incarcerated offense is driving under suspension, non-DUI related. And so who would not want to try to fix that situation?
Thank you.
Representative, may I add Utah's experience to that? We knew we had a lot of drug offenders in prison, but because we thought we knew that everybody in Utah prisons have a very lengthy felony record, we never looked any further than that. We never did the deeper data dive to figure out their criminal histories because we thought we knew the answers. After we figured that out and fought with Pew about it for a long time about whether or not the data was accurate, then we were quite alarmed.
Excellent. Representative Klayman.
Senator Malloy, I think I speak on behalf of all of us that your loss in your Senate is our loss as well.
Thank you.
But I wanted to particularly speak about you talked a little bit about giving judges more discretion, and I think one of the sort of things that goes on is you sort of have this dynamic going on between legislative power, executive power, and judicial power, and that when you get these mandatory minimums, what you're essentially doing is saying we don't trust judges to get the right sentence, and so we create these sentencing laws. We've done it on the federal level, too, where you have these sentencing laws that require certain sentences for certain offenses and take away from the judge the discretion to tailor the sentence to the offender. Has that been an effort that you've done in South Carolina to essentially recognize we've got to put a little more trust in the judiciary to figure it out?
Yes, sir, and I think it may be a little bit more unique, Representative Clayman, to our state because the General Assembly elects the judges. And so we're not, I'm not certain how to do it here, but it's not popularly elected.
We have merit selection, but it's through the governor and not the legislature.
So we have a merit selection committee. I'm on the merit selection. We go through the process. We're screened by the bar. We're screened by the public. And then we select three, and they take them before the General Assembly. And so I think that the checks and balances that we end up having, obviously, candidly, if you want to find someone that knows the General Assembly very well in South Carolina, the judges know the General Assembly very well. Out of the 124 members in the House of Representatives, I'm embarrassing saying that I don't think I can name them all. But I think the judges can. And I think to your point is that if I have a judge that I'm going to give that judge flexibility, it's like anything else that you end up having. You treat them responsibly, and they respond responsibly. Now, one of the things that we wanted to do to try to have our checks and balances was we wanted to put together a manual of sentences throughout our state, because in our urban areas and our rural areas, we're trying to see whether or not the judges would end up giving sentences different in one area than another, particularly during budgetary times when the judges don't travel around as much. We never got to that point. But I would say that in order, when we moved our package along, the judges in our state became very supportive of these measures, and they have seen now is that for whatever reason that it worked, it has worked because our crime rates are down probably in the 8% range throughout the entire state.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, for your service to your state and for the work that you've done to turn your justice system around. And thank you for traveling here to share it with us. I hope you enjoy Alaska and Godspeed. And so now we're going to bring up the final group. And if they want to come up together, that's fine. We've got Terry Schuster, Justice Brenner, Diane Castro, and this is the PowerPoint on the Pew Charitable Trust for Alaska. Wonderful. Welcome, the three of you, and if you just we know you, but if you put your name on the record, we'd appreciate that.
My name is Terry Schuster. I'm here with the Pew Charitable Trusts.
I'm Diane Casto, and I am now with the Department of Corrections.
Alex Brenner. I'm a retired Alaska Supreme Court Justice and currently serving as chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, proudly so.
So the slides that we are showing today are data slides. If you have questions about the data, we're specifically going to be talking about what's driving the growth in Alaska's prison population, and looking forward, if additional reforms are not made, what future prison growth Alaska is looking at. So
for members, we have a lot of handouts here, but this is the one entitled Alaska Prison Growth Drivers and Costs, dated August 18th.
So if you have questions along the way about the data, I'm happy to field those questions. If you have questions that are more specific to the Department of Corrections or the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, then Deputy Director Casto and Justice Brenner are here to field those questions. Alaska's prison population has grown 27% in the last decade. That's a significant amount of growth over a 10-year period. What we'd like to do with this presentation is examine what has driven that growth and help you all and help the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission identify some areas that may be worth examination for and policy discussion. So we took a look at who is in Alaska prisons right now and broke it up into three inmate types. So starting at the bottom left corner of this pie graph, you have pretrial population. A little bit more than a quarter of Alaska's prison inmates are in pretrial. To the right of that, the sentence population, about half of the inmates in Alaska's prisons have been sentenced to a term of imprisonment. And then the last piece, a little bit less than a quarter of the population are probationers and parolees who have violated the terms of their supervision and who are in prison either because they've been revoked or because they are awaiting a revocation hearing. So we'd like to sort of break apart each of these three and take a look at the growth in each of these inmate populations over time and try to have a better understanding of what is driving that growth. Here's a stacked bar graph looking at those same populations over time. So the bar graph on the bar on the left looks at the prison population in 2005. The bar on the right looks at the population in 2014. The purple part of the bar at the bottom represents sentenced offenders. That population is the largest portion of the prison population, and it has grown 14% in the last decade. One up from there, the sort of lighter green segment of the bar represents pretrial inmates, pretrial defendants. That population has grown 81% in the last decade. And the top portion is supervision violators, that's probation and parole violators, and that portion of the population has also grown 15% over the last decade. We'll take them each one at a time and try to explain a little bit more about what's driving the growth, starting with pretrial. So the pretrial population, like we said, has grown 81% in the last decade. There are generally two things that can lead to growth like this. There could either be more people coming into prison pretrial than there were 10 years ago, or there could be people spending more time in prison during that pretrial period than they did 10 years ago, or it could be both. So we'll look at each of those. This is who's coming in and how it's changed over time. So on the left, we have a bar of 2005, all of the prison admissions pretrial in 2005. And then on the right side, all the prison admissions pretrial in 2014. And what we've done with the colors on the bar is break up by crime charge severity. So at the top, in that darker green segment of the bar graph, we're looking at people who come into prison pretrial on nonviolent misdemeanor charges. One down from there, the lighter green, are people coming in on violent misdemeanor charges, pretrial. The darker purple is nonviolent felony charges, and the lighter purple is violent felony charges. So the first takeaway from this data is that there are fewer people who came into prison in 2014 pretrial than there were in 2005. So this growth that we've seen over the last decade, it's not driven by more people coming in pretrial. It's driven by people staying for longer periods of time pretrial. So that said, even though prison admissions pretrial are not driving the growth, there's some interesting data points on the slide. So let's talk about that before we move on to talk about length of stay pretrial.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I could interject, just it was about the third or fourth time I've seen the data. So some things really jump out now, you know, that didn't initially. And this particular slide is really stunning, you know, and it took a while with me. I'm a slow responder, I guess. But what this means is we have people coming into pretrial spending more time, pre-adjudication than they. And just the implication of that with our values constitutionally of a speedy trial and quick and so forth, and just the guilty until or innocent until proven guilty, you know. So we have these people spending more time incarcerated before this court action, and I think that this is a very alarming warning signal. And I just forgive me, but the alarm was slow building in my head, so that's why I wanted to express it now. So thank you.
Further
question? Mm-hmm. So on the next slide, we'll look at those longer lengths of stay and try to break that down a little bit. On this slide, though, if we look at the bar on the right, the 2014 pretrial admissions to prison, you can see that over 11,000 people were admitted to prison pretrial, meaning they were arrested and they were detained and held pretrial for nonviolent misdemeanor charges. That's more than half of all of the people who came in to prison pretrial last year. If we look at the nonviolent misdemeanors and the violent misdemeanors together, so all of the people who came in on non-felony charges, that's 75% of all of the pretrial prison admissions. So here's the slide where we look at length of stay pretrial. What we've done, again, is break out length of stay by the severity of the charge that people were held on. And we have a light blue bar next to a dark blue bar. The light blue bar is the 2005 average length of stay pretrial. And the dark blue bar is the 2014 average length of stay pretrial. So if we start looking at the bars on the far right, these are the nonviolent misdemeanor charges. On average, in 2014, people who came into prison on these charges, nonviolent misdemeanor charges, were staying about 3 days longer than they did in 2005. That doesn't sound like a really big increase in length of stay, just 3 days, but recall that we're talking about thousands and thousands of people who are coming in on nonviolent misdemeanor charges. And so, if you take an increase of 3 days and you multiply it by thousands and thousands of people, that can add up to a lot of prison beds that Alaska wasn't using 10 years ago. If we take a look, moving one left from there, at the violent misdemeanor defendants, they're staying about a week longer than they used to. The nonviolent felony defendants are staying about 3 weeks longer than they used to pretrial, and violent felony defendants are staying about a month longer than they used to. So these are those increases, Representative Keller, in length of stay pre-trial. Before we move on and talk about the sentenced population and the growth in that population, are there questions about the pre-trial population?
Yes, Representative Klayman.
Just going back to the earlier slide, is it fair to say, at least as to the violent and nonviolent felony matters, those are likely a reflection of people who never get released, and that's just how long it takes for them to get to trial or to plea? Or do you have that level of detail on your analysis?
I would actually be hesitant to say that. I think the majority of people who are coming in pretrial are misdemeanor defendants.
Right.
And there are a good amount of misdemeanor defendants who are also never released during their pretrial period. We have some data on that. We took a sample of court case files and reviewed them to look at bail conditions and how long people stayed pretrial. Of that sample, which was mostly misdemeanor cases, more than half of the defendants were never released during the pretrial period. That said, for those felony charges, those charges are more likely to go to trial, and so they may be staying longer periods of time because they're headed toward trial and there's negotiations going on back and forth. They're also one of the things that's likely keeping people detained is the amount of bail, the dollar amount of bail that's being set.
Mm.
And so it's possible that people with these felony offenses are having higher dollar amounts of bail set.
Just a short follow-up. It strikes me that as a policy matter, we should be particularly interested in trying to reduce the pretrial sentence, pretrial time on both the felony and the misdemeanor nonviolent offenses.
Yeah. We think that's an area that the commission is likely to focus on as well, is that length of stay pretrial. And we'll talk at the end, we'll talk about sort of the next steps for policy discussions at the commission level and the recommendations that will be coming to you all for consideration in the next legislative session. So the sentence population makes up half of the prison population in Alaska, and that population has also been growing. So we see, looking back 10 years, the portion or the number of people in prison on as sentenced offenders has increased 14%. This is a slide that looks similar to the one you saw before for pretrial. Again, we're looking at who's coming in and how long are they staying. So who's coming in here, we're looking at prison admissions for people as sentenced offenders, so people who were sentenced to prison for a period of time. In 2005, you can see that the number of people sent to prison as sentenced offenders was higher than in 2014. So admissions to prison for sentenced offenders is not what's driving this growth. Again, it's length of stay for people who've been sentenced to prison. While we're on this slide, though, let's take a look at 2014 and see who's coming in as sentenced offenders. We did the same kind of color scheme as the last slide that you saw, where at the top we're looking at nonviolent misdemeanor offenders, and moving down from there, violent misdemeanor offenders, nonviolent felony offenders, and violent felony offenders. Over 6,500 people last year were sentenced to a term in prison for a nonviolent misdemeanor offense. When we look at that part of the graph with the dark green and the light green together, all of the people who were sentenced to prison on misdemeanors, that makes up 82% of people who were sentenced to prison last year.
Representative Ledoux.
So do you have any idea of those folks who were sentenced for nonviolent misdemeanors? How many of them were actually charged with, for example, violent misdemeanors and perhaps then only ended up pleading to a nonviolent one?
I don't have that information, no. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this slide begins to look at length of stay for sentenced offenders. What we're looking at here are different categories of nonviolent felony offenses. So from left to right, we're looking at felony property offenders, felony drug offenders, felony alcohol offenders, and felony public order offenders. And what the bars are measuring are the average length of stay in days in 2005, the light blue bar, and in 2014, the dark blue bar. So we can see the first sort of thing to note is that length of stay has increased across the board for all types of nonviolent felony offenders. When we look at the far left, property offenders and drug offenders, they're each staying about a month longer than they used to as sentenced offenders. When we look at alcohol and public order offenders, they're staying about 3 months longer than they used to. An increase of 1 month, an increase of 3 months, it doesn't sound like a very big increase, but multiplied by hundreds and thousands of cases, that adds up to a lot of prison beds that Alaska was not using 10 years ago.
Representative Ledoux.
What is a felony public order offense?
A lot of those offenses are weapons offenses. A felon who was in possession of a weapon, or they can also be, I wonder... have to look this up exactly. I know the misdemeanor public order offenses are often things like disorderly conduct. I don't know if there are aggravated versions of that that become felonies.
Thank you. Interesting.
So to recap, oh, I'm sorry, before we recap, we'll move on to violent felony offenders. Violent felony offenders are also spending longer in prison than they used to. There are two categories of violent felonies in Alaska, person offenses and registrable sex offenses. Person offenses are staying about 17% longer than they used to in prison as sentenced offenders. Sex offenders are spending about 86% longer than they used to 10 years ago on average. The way that we arrived at this average length of stay was looking only at people who'd been released. And you look at when they were admitted to prison, when they were released from prison, and you come up with their length of stay. So for people who got very, very long sentences, 40, 50, 60 plus years, their length of stay is not calculated in this graph because they just haven't been released yet. And so in some ways this is a conservative estimate of length of stay because it doesn't include those very long sentences for people who haven't yet been released. So a quick recap on sentenced offenders. There are a lot of low-level offenders being sentenced to prison. When we look at length of stay has increased across the board for all nonviolent felony types and also for violent felony types. And it's this increases in length of stay that's been driving the growth in the sentence population. Are there questions again on the sentence population before we move on and talk about probation and parole violators? All right. So probation and parole violators, we've seen more of them in 2014 than in 2005. This is a snapshot on one day, July 1st, 2005 and July 1st, 2014. Again, the things that can contribute to this growth are more people coming into prison on supervision violations or people staying for longer periods of time on supervision violations. So we took a look at that data, both of those data points in this slide, which is a little bit complicated, so take just a moment to explain it. What we've done here is look at how many people are coming into prison on probation and parole revocations. The light blue bars are the people who are came in 2005 on revocations. The dark blue bars are people who came in 2014 on revocations. What we've done is break out the revocations by how long of a term of imprisonment was imposed for the revocation. So there are some people who were given 0 to 7 days as their sanction for their revocation. And then we have 8 to 30 days, 1 to 3 months, 3 to 6 months, 6 months to a year, et cetera. The first takeaway is that in most of these length of stay categories, you have more people who were revoked in 2014 than you did in 2005. You've got a lot more revocations coming into prison. The biggest growth looks to be in that short period of time, 0 to 7 days. And this may be in part related to the creation and expansion of the PACE program, where people are coming in on very short revocation sanctions. The PACE program, as you all know, is focused on high-risk offenders that are on probation. When they violate conditions, they'd be coming in on short revocation length of stay. It also captures people who, when they have a revocation hearing in front of the court or the parole board, they get something like a time-served sentence. So on average, people are waiting about a month before they have a revocation hearing. They're detained on a petition to revoke. They wait for a month, and they have the hearing, and then the judge or the parole board may say, well, you've been here a month. I'll give you time served. And so then they would fall into that 0 to 7 days because they would just get a zero-day revocation or a one-day revocation. Notably, we also see increases in these longer lengths of stay revocations also. So there are more people who are revoked for up to a month, more people revoked for 1 to 3 months, more people revoked 3 to 6 months, and even more people revoked 6 months to a year. That's notable because of a pretty robust body of research that goes against, essentially reducing recidivism for people on community supervision has to do with swift and certain sanctions that are proportional to the violation. When you have these longer lengths of stay imposed for technical violations, that goes against that body of research, and it can actually be really disruptive to people's lives.
Representative Woody?
Yes.
So do most of these people who are going in for revocations, are they committing other crimes, or are they just screwing up their parole?
So sometimes it's both, right? Sometimes people are coming in on technical violations, and they also have some new criminal activity that's being investigated. When we break up, let me go back to this slide. When we break up offenders into these inmate types, if someone is coming in on a new charge for a new crime, they fall in the pretrial group because they're being processed for a new crime. And if someone's coming in on a technical violation, they're going to fall in the supervision violators group. And so when we talk about these supervision violators, generally we're talking about people coming in on technical violations.
So just follow up. So what would happen if you just decided, okay, they've served X amount of time in prison, they don't have any parole? I mean, what good is the parole doing?
I think this is a complicated question. It's a great question. There are a lot of people who actually are coming in. They get a sentence of 24 months in prison with 22 months suspended. And so they'll get 2 months in prison, and then they'll have probation afterwards. So most people are actually are released with probation, some period of probation already attached to their sentence. When you have people who are also released on parole, they end up being on both parole and probation at the same time.
And I'm confused about as the difference actually between the parole and probation for somebody who's finished up in jail.
I can clarify that under Alaska law, probation happens when you have a portion of a sentence that is imposed but is suspended that you don't have to serve, as long as you're on good behavior and comply with conditions imposed by the court. If you violate those conditions, you can have your probationary period unsuspended, and the remainder or a portion of the remainder of your sentence can be imposed. Parole occurs when you're sentenced into prison for a specific time. In serving your time, if you serve your time and get credit for good time served, under the parole provisions, you get a certain amount of credit for good time that shortens the actual sentence, and you can get released before you your actual number of days are served. When you're released to parole, which means, again, you have to comply with conditions of service. You have to comply with all the conditions of your parole, where it's just like probation there. And if you violate them, you can be taken back to the court, and then the court can impose the rest of that sentence. And you can be forced to serve the rest of your unserved sentence.
Thank you. Can I just follow up? So what would happen if you just decided, okay, 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or however much you decided is the time for jail or prison for the time, and then you just did away with parole? I mean, if you're ending up with a significant number of people who are just not going in for actually any new crime, but just because they failed a technical provision of parole. I mean, would Western civilization crumble if we just did away with it?
I think I can say that, at least in my view and from what I've heard, Western civilization probably wouldn't crumble. And as a matter of fact, Western civilization is pretty practical. As a practical matter, one of the strategies to deal with that situation so we don't unreasonably impose excess time is to have technical violations be approached as something that warrant technical stays back in jail for a short period of time to shock the offender and make the offender know that, you know, this could be serious, we'll give you another chance. And typically with most offenders, I think the statistics show, and Pew would be able to back me up on this, but that tends to be a very successful strategy. In other words, instead of going full bore and taking away all the probationary time, give them a shock first and a short period of probation, show them that we're still there watching, and they'll be compliant there. Especially with low-risk offenders.
Thank you.
There are also a lot of benefits to community supervision for people who are coming out of prison, particularly in those first few weeks and months right when people get out, to have some extra support, to be held accountable, to have some people who are holding them accountable in those moments when they are really sort of most likely to have some trouble reentering the community. And at some point, you know, now or down the road, Deputy Director Castro can talk more about the reentry efforts that the department has is working on to make sure that during those moments when people are transitioning and leaving prison that they have some support in place and a plan for success. Did you want to talk more?
Again, Diane Castro, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. I've been listening throughout the day, and first of all, for those of you who don't know, I've been on the job just a little over 2 months. So it is a huge system, as we have just talked about today. It is a complicated system, and I am still getting up to speed on all of it. But I will say I did work in the field of health and social services, 20 years with the state, 17 years in the nonprofit world, and when I left health and social services to go to corrections, everyone said, oh my gosh, it's so different. The reality is, it's not so different. It's the same, many of the same people, it's just further down the continuum of care. And so with that, the issues related to recidivism reduction and reentry programming, that is where we are putting a lot of our efforts within the Department of Corrections, and indeed one of the reasons that Commissioner Taylor brought me on, because of my experience working with communities, with our partners, with establishing services, doing case management. These are things that we have not done a lot of in Department of Corrections before. In fact, I know that many of the staff, when they heard a social work kind of person was coming on, was like, oh, no. And I keep using the term case management a lot. So we are changing kind of our vocabulary, but that's what we're talking about when we're talking about reentry. And to your point, Representative Ledoux, of how, what is it that we can do to assist people, not hold them, you know, just say we're gonna keep watching you, but what is it we can do to help guide them, help provide them with the services they need, to help them re-enter the community in a positive way. For many of our inmates who have been in the prison system for a long time, it's a real shock to come back out on the other side, and suddenly the friends you had before are gone, your family members may be gone, you have no house, you have no job, you have a substance abuse problem that you're still struggling with, you may have a mental health situation. These are, you know, when you think about the huge number of challenges that our returning citizens have, the fact that any of them survive and do it well is amazing. So through reentry, our plan is to work with our community partners. We work strongly with Department of Labor, with our unions to do apprenticeship programs, to train our inmates, to give them good skills before they're released. We work with our partners in housing, and the AHFC, how do we make sure they have housing lined up before they get out? And again, the services. You know, we talked about the number of folks with mental health and substance abuse. I will tell you, there are a number of issues that really surprised me when I came into Department of Corrections. One of them was not just the number of mental health cases, but the severity of the mental health cases. We are talking about severe situations in many cases. And I've been working for the last 15 years in mental health and substance abuse, and I was surprised that it was as severe as it is. The number of substance abuse and addiction problems, again, not a surprise that they are there, but a surprise at how significant some of those are and how long term these conditions have been, which also led to one of my other surprises, which was the number and the seriousness of the physical health issues. When you are someone who has had an addiction for 20 years of either alcohol or drugs, you have not had medical care, you've not had access to medical care, your health condition is pretty serious. And we have so many of our inmates that have severe health problems, heart and cardiology issues, lungs and you know, asthma, breathing, COPD, diabetes, cirrhosis, it just goes on and on. And so those are some of the things that have surprised me. And as we begin developing our partnerships with our communities, we've got to think about all of these things and how we're going to help move folks back into the communities. We currently have 4 reentry coalitions in 4 communities, in Fairbanks, Matsu, Anchorage, and Juneau. We, through some funding with the Alaska Mental Health Trust, we're going to be awarding some grants to those 4 communities so they can hire coordinators, and we can really start developing, looking at what is available in those communities in terms of services so that we can do a better job of laying out a plan for those returning citizens so that they don't come back on technical violations or they don't come back just because they need a place to live. I was on a tour this morning at the Anchorage complex. We were taking someone from the governor's office on a tour, and the gentleman, the sergeant that was giving us a tour, was talking about the number of people that will commit these low-level crimes just so they can get back into prison, because at least there they had a place to live. They had 3 meals a day. They had health care. That is heartbreaking to me, and we have got to change that so we have better services on the outside than we do on the inside so we can help people be successful.
I know we're running short on time. I thought I might skip a couple slides and just go to one big takeaway slide about future prison growth, if that would be all right. This is another complex slide. It takes a little bit of explanation, but starting with the title, absent further reform, the prison population is projected to grow 27%, that's over the next decade, costing at least $169 million. What we tracked here in this graph is looking back 10 years and looking forward 10 years, the average daily population in Alaska prisons. So where the line changes colors is in 2015, and moving forward from 2015 is a projection of 1,400 additional prison beds required unless some reforms are put in place. So this graph, again, is based on assumptions that after July 1st, 2015, there are no more reform efforts, either at the administrative level or at the legislative level, aimed at curbing this prison growth. So with that assumption built in, that prison growth would happen. The dotted line across the graph represents the hard prison bed capacity in Alaska. So you can see in 2017, absent reforms, the prison projected population would surpass the current prison bed capacity. That would require the reopening of a facility that's currently closed. It's a 128-bed facility. By 2018, those 128 beds in the reopened facility would be filled, and again, the hard bed capacity would be surpassed. At the point where reopening facilities and where the population would surpass that expanded capacity, we'd then be looking at shipping offenders out of state. So the transportation costs and the contracting costs, plus the cost of reopening the closed facility, would be at least $169 million. If the state decided to keep prisoners here in Alaska, then that cost of building a prison here with the capacity to house this additional 1,400 prisoners would likely cost much more than $169 million. I believe the cost on the Goose Creek facility was around $240 million. So are there any questions about this slide before we move on and talk about next steps of the commission? Okay. As you all know, the governor and speaker and Senate president have come together with other leaders and have agreed upon a process aimed at curbing this future prison growth that you see on the graph, and doing that in a way that's safe and that protects public safety and holds offenders accountable. They've charged the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission with developing a comprehensive package of recommendations for reforms, and those would be statutory reforms and budgetary reforms for your consideration in the coming legislative session, The commission is a diverse group of stakeholders. It includes lawmakers, Representative Keller and Senator Coghill are both members of the commission, as are a number of judges, law enforcement members, the Department of Corrections, attorneys like the Attorney General and the Public Defender. There's also members who are representing Alaska Natives, crime victims, and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. They have been hard at work for about a year. They've been holding meetings and public hearings. They've been gathering testimony from around the state. In September, we'll be holding crime victim roundtables in Fairbanks and in Bethel. The whole commission will be traveling up to Nome and Kotzebue and surrounding villages to make sure that people's voices are heard from remote and rural areas in the state as well, and make sure that practitioners out there and members of the public out there also have a chance to give input. Over the next several months, in September, October, and November, the commission will be holding policy development meetings, and will come out with a report with recommendations in December for your consideration. So at this point, I've just left a placeholder for questions. I know that we're over time. Thank you all so much for inviting our testimony. Please let me know if you have questions.
Excellent. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you in your endeavors on getting out into rural Alaska. I just wanted to encourage you to keep doing that and support you very much in that, and glad that you're being very open in terms of, you know, just the entire state on that issue. So thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for the presentation. Thank you for the work you're doing on the commission, and it's nice to have a few here in the state helping us come up with some data. It was delightful to hear the other representatives from different states talking about how they've incorporated your data into turning things around. So we look forward to hearing from you and getting some useful facts. And with that, anything you'd like to add, Justice Brenner?
Just one thing, yes. Sarah. I would like to thank the Pew Commission for coming in and helping us. They really have the technical expertise to make the process that we're engaged at not a hit-and-miss process, but a data-driven process that has the background and the experience to encourage us to believe that we know what we're doing, and that what we're doing is something that can succeed. At the same time, I would thank all three branches of government for agreeing to invite the Pew Trust people to come in and handle it, and also thank the legislature and on a bipartisan basis for adopting SB 64, which gave us the authority and set out the guidelines that we could follow to undertake and complete this process. It was a very, I think, and all commission members participating would agree, it's a very insightful and very timely action that you took, and so we're very grateful to you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Ellis, obviously as a co-prime on that bill, and for joining us today in the Judiciary Committee. And to the House and Senate members, thank you for your time, and with that, we're adjourned.